Seconded by Mr. Goldman. Thank you. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Any abstention? Abstentions? The minutes are approved. Thank you. We have two items on today's agenda. Both require board member trainings. Our first item is the board's annual ethics training. The board's code of ethics requires that each member receive in-person ethics training annually, and today's session reflects the recent updates that the board made to the code of ethics. The second item is the board's annual audit awareness training, which is required for board members as part of their oversight responsibilities. I would like to note that since these training sessions are required of all board members, today we're joined by the board's alternate directors this afternoon. First, as I said earlier, there's the annual ethics training, which will last about 20 or so minutes, and then we'll have a committee discussion. Then we'll move on to the annual audit training. So I'll turn it over to Ms. Lee and Mr. Staub.
Thank you very much. So I'll just jump right into it. I know this has been a long day already. This is your annual ethics training as required by the Board of Code of Ethics. In addition to the annual ethics training, we strongly encourage board members to regularly review the Code of Ethics. What Phil and I will cover today is fiduciary duties, conflicts of interest, disclosures, no personal liability and official immunity, and take you through some scenarios. So who do board members owe their fiduciary duties to? And this is embodied in the compact. The compact is an instrumentality and agency of each of the signatory body parties and the embodied corporate politic. So as a result, board members owe their fiduciary duties to both WMATA and their respective jurisdictions. What are the fiduciary duties that you owe to WMATA and your respective jurisdictions or before? Duty of loyalty, duty of confidentiality, duty of care, and duty to avoid conflicts of interest. And I'll go through each of these briefly. Duty of loyalty. That basically means you should act in the best interest of WMATA or your jurisdiction in good faith, and you should do so objectively and independently. For example, the action should not be in the interest of yourself, another person, or another organization. Duty of confidentiality. This is a duty to keep confidential all non-public information involving WMATA matters that you learn through your board service. Disclosure of non-public information potentially could result in violation, statutory violations or waiver or loss of client privilege. Duty of care. Act with appropriate attention and be fully apprised of all reasonably available information. Essentially, this means when you act as board members, you know, you should attend board meetings, ask questions, and gather information so that you can make an informed decision before you act. Duty to avoid conflicts of interest. Avoid any action that would diminish the public's confidence in the integrity of the board or WMATA. What are examples? For example, do not use your board position for favored treatment of any person or entity. Do not use your board position for personal gain. Do not solicit or accept gifts, money, or anything of value in connection with your service as a board member. What is a conflict of interest? As the board knows, we used to have the prior ethics code distinguish between apparent and actual conflict of interest. We only have one definition now, which is broader. A conflict of interest is when a board member's ability to perform his or her duties fairly and objectively would be compromised. Conflicts of interest include, but are not limited to, when a board member has a substantial duty or interest in an interested party. Resolving conflicts of interest. There is recusal. Recusal, no approval is necessary. That would have to be a public recusal. You're not allowed
No, no. I've asked them all before.
Okay. Disclosures. And so there are disclosures, and again, this helps yourself as board members and helps the ethics officer help us identify potential conflicts of interest and where we may have to recuse or where it may be appropriate to make a declaration. And those would be in your annual disclosure statements. There's a continuing disclosure obligation. So if something comes up throughout the year that may rise to a conflict of interest, you have an obligation to raise that potential conflict of interest, discuss it with the ethics officer, and if there's in fact a conflict of interest, or you're an interested party who has substantial interest in a new vendor or matter, then you would have to disclose that throughout the year, and then give disclosures. Gifts are generally not acceptable. There's some exceptions, and to the extent an exception applies, you're required to fill out a gift disclosure. So you have that for the record. No personal liability or official immunity to a board member. I've been asked this question a couple times, so I thought I'd include this time in the training. So board members are not personally liable for breaches of contracts or torts. The compact provides that the exclusive remedy of any plaintiff is against the authority, so you cannot be sued in your personal capacity. Board members enjoy official immunity for discretionary conduct within the scope of his or her official duties. So it's both factors have to come into play. One, it has to be discretionary conduct, and two, your actions must be within the scope of your duty or responsibility. The immunity protection may be lost where a board member acts in a manner that is manifestly, and this is a quote from a Supreme Court case, manifestly or palpably beyond his or her authority. And basically, it just means if it's, you know, clearly, obviously, flagrantly beyond your scope of duty, then the immunity may not stand. Okay. Any questions?
Is there a Dean of policy that covers?
Yes. There is.
So if one person, the policy would kick in?
Yeah. Yes.
And that would apply even if you're a board member who's been vulnerable to the board?
Exactly. It applies to your action that you took in the scope, you know, while you were a board member, to the extent the action was within your duties and responsibilities.
It is a further step is required, condition must be satisfied, I think, which is action by the board to make the indemnity available to the director in question. Is that, so it doesn't just kick in. I mean, it's discretionary to the board whether indemnification under the is available to a director. No, it's not.
Well, the insurance, the D&O insurance policy covers board member actions that are within the scope and duty of his or her responsibility. Are you asking whether there needs to be a board vote?
Yes.
No, it doesn't. I think what you may be referring to is a board vote for indemnifying costs associated as opposed to the actual liabilities.
But isn't the insurance policy predicated on the person in question actually being indemnified? Thus, the board must act before the. Okay. All right.
Yeah, the insurance policy covers board members who take actions that are within his or her scope. Okay. The indemnification is separate to the extent that you're not covered. You can still ask the board to indemnify.
And the costs of defending against the action are either borne by the authority if it's done in-house or indemnified to the member if they have a different, and that's where the board action comes in, if they choose outside counsel.
Right. Well, there, yes.
Do you have another question?
Well, the indemnity isn't available, but the indemnity is not available for internal investigations. It's only available for external suits against third party.
When it's a government action, I mean, if it is an external government action, if it starts out as an internal and goes to an external body,
gotcha.
We have to look at that. We have an indemnity policy that sets that out when a board member can be indemnified. So if employees may be indemnified, that requires the GM's approval, and the board members may be indemnified, and that requires
Good afternoon. We have five different scenarios that are meant to illustrate the rules of the Code of Ethics and to cover some common situations. We hope that your takeaways from this will include that ethics situations are very fact-dependent, to rely on advice from and take advantage of advice from the ethics officer, and to that disclosure is your friend. In this first scenario, I won't read them out. They're all on the screen right now, or one at a time. On the first one, you have an adult son who works for a WMATA vendor. This is here to talk about conflicts of interest. So, first of all, with the conflict of interest, you're looking for a source of the conflict. And here you have a WMATA vendor, so that's per se an interested party. So then the next question is, do you have a substantial interest or duty in the interested party? So this highlights a couple things. First of all, the interests of your household members are imputed to you. So before even getting to substantial interest or duty, consider whether the son in this scenario is a household member. And things like not living in the house, being financially independent, establish that the son is not a household member. So we can conclude that there's no substantial interest or duty in this interested party on behalf of this hypothetical member. However, that's not the entire definition of a conflict. The definition of a conflict also includes an examination of whether it would compromise your ability to perform duties fairly and objectively. So this is where I would encourage you to consult with the ethics officer to determine this based on a more complete set of facts. But just based on what we have here, this scenario specifies that the son, the income does not vary based on the business with WMATA. So this is the sort of situation where the son is certainly receiving some sort of benefit. I mean, the more business his company has, the better off presumably he's going to be with his employment. So it's a situation that I would likely advise making a declaration. But it would also be the board member's choice to use recusal. Recusal is a bit more straightforward. The board member's is largely in control of that. Declaration requires a recommendation from the ethics officer, which under these circumstances I would give, and approval of the full board. But note how fact-sensitive this is. Just change something slightly, like the son gets a bonus each year, depending on how well the company did. Well, now that's more of a direct benefit, and your relationship, obviously, with the son is quite close in terms of familial relationship. That would likely interfere with your ability to perform your duties fairly and objectively, notwithstanding the lack of a substantial interest or duty in the interested party. We more likely focus on recusal as an option. I'm going to move through these scenarios, but pause just briefly between each one in case you have any questions. In scenario two, this is a CEO of a property developer that offers ballet tickets to your partner or spouse. It specifies that the developer is not doing business with Metro, but does do business in the Metro area. So this, again, is a household member issue, and as well as it presents a gift. So first of all, your partner, spouse, is a household member, even if you've been kicked out recently. You do not have to live in the same place. So you do have to be careful about your definition of household member there, but let's assume everything's going well. Household member is subject to the same gift rules that you are as a board member. So consider this as if the ballet tickets are coming to you. So this is how we analyze the gift. First of all, we ask the basic question, well, does it qualify as a gift? That's pretty easy. A gift is anything of value. So check that box. Next, is the person giving the gift a prohibited source? We just don't have enough facts here to determine that. I mean, we know the business is this developer is not doing business with Metro, but there are other bases to be an interested party or a prohibited source. The developer could own property that would be affected by decisions of Metro, or could be a prohibited source because the ballet tickets are being offered because you are a member of the board. For instance, it's being offered to prominent members of boards throughout the Washington region. That would be a big hint for why your partner is getting this. So let's just assume then, for the sake of going through the analysis, that it is a prohibited source. Then you need to ask, is there an exception that would allow me to accept the gift? And the first one we tend to think about is the dollar threshold, the $25 threshold. I'm going to assume, pretty safely, that a ballet ticket costs more than $25. Now, could there be another exception? There are exceptions that come into play with household members, like maybe the household member has a personal relationship with the CEO, and the CEO each year has given your spouse a ballet ticket or something similar. Well, that would indicate that it's being given for those personal reasons. There are others that could apply to household members as well, so we'd need to explore that to see if there's an exception. Let's again just assume that it meets an exception and you can accept the tickets. If it does not, however, you would decline, you'd ask your spouse to decline the offer of the tickets. But again, if it does meet an exception, remember, all gifts from prohibited sources are reported, so you would need to report the receipt of the tickets. In this third scenario, pretty straightforward situation. You serve on the board of a nonprofit. What do you need to do in terms of your obligations under the Metro Code of Ethics? Well, being on a board is a fiduciary position. A fiduciary position is one of our listed substantial interests or duty. So the first thing you want to do is disclose that. There's a section under which in our disclosure form to provide that. Now, there are some exceptions from the requirement of reporting fiduciary positions. If you feel that it might fit within those exceptions, that's something we probably ought to talk about. So another place that I would encourage you to seek advice. Well, once you disclose, are you done? Not quite. When you have a substantial interest or duty, you need to watch out for whether the other piece of the conflict of interest comes into play, that the nonprofit becomes an interested party. It could happen. It's not that likely with a nonprofit, but the nonprofit could be affected by a decision of Metro, as just one example. Also, seeing as how I said right at the start that that's not the only definition of a conflict of interest, if you were to be otherwise compromised in performing your duties fairly and objectively, let's say a nonprofit is taking a position on an issue before the board, you'd be torn between your fiduciary duty to the nonprofit and your duties to Metro. So again, that's another possibility for a conflict that we would need to address. So again, more opportunities to seek advice and make disclosures. Scenario four. Here you are providing consulting services. So consulting, presumably you're not doing it for free. You're getting some income from this. You're providing personal representation. Those are both substantial interests and duties. So right away we've triggered a potential conflict situation here, certainly a disclosure situation, because right away you have that personal representation. Again, that is a section in your disclosure. Now, in this scenario, when you submitted your initial disclosure, your annual disclosure, the this business was not an interested party. It then submitted a bid. At that point, when it submitted a bid, that's what triggers the disclosure requirement. We don't require that you disclose all entities that for which you provide services, but you do need to disclose once they become an interested party. So that within 10 days of that event, of them submitting the bid, or your knowledge of them submitting a bid, you would update your disclosure and look for whether their interests are affected by any matters before the board from which you would need to recuse yourself. The scenario provides, however, that... question.
When you're done.
Oh, okay. Let me just cover a couple more things. Scenario provides that the business for which you provide consulting services that submitted a bid on a metro contract was not successful. So let's say shortly thereafter, you've submitted your annual disclosure where you didn't need to report them. You need to report them once they became an interested party, so you amended your disclosure, and you're coming up on disclosures again. You learn that they were unsuccessful in their bid. Do you still need to disclose them? Well, strictly speaking, if they're not an interested party, you wouldn't need to disclose them anymore. But consider that since they already expressed interest in Metro work, they may bid again, which would make them an interested party. They may now be affected by decisions of Metro. It's another place to seek advice. It's another place where I would err on the side of disclosure, perhaps not in the section regarding personal representation, but we have a section that captures other potential interests that you would report it. Is there a question about this?
Just a couple things that flow from this. So in the scenario as you've described it, although I provide consulting services to the business, I am not providing consulting services for the preparation of and submission of that bid. So even if I'm not involved in the work on the bid itself, that business relationship makes it a disclosable situation, and presumably if the board has something to do with that decision, that's a recusal situation as well, correct?
That's all correct. That's
yes.
Right. Yeah, regardless of whether you're working on the particular matter that they have with Metro, your income from the entity is what creates the potential conflict.
And then on a going forward basis, as a potential interested party in future actions, I would need to watch that for future recusals on my end as well.
Exactly.
Now, my instinct is this is not a scenario that should ever happen, but if the business for whom I provide services asks for my assistance in preparing the bid, that strikes me as extremely off limits, but I don't know how to say that in the technical terms you might be able to.
Well, the technical term, I mean, yes, you've certainly ramped up the conflict. It doesn't actually change. What you may be thinking about is that there's a compact prohibition on members doing business with Metro, for that matter, officers and employees as well. That becomes something that we can't cure through simple recusal.
Right.
But what you're describing, you haven't quite gotten there yet. Now, if you said partner with us on this bid, now we fit the compact restriction.
Yeah, so that is simply an action. That's an action that is just simply barred as board members.
That's right.
Thank you.
The compact conflict of interest cannot be cured by recusal.
Right.
Phil, can I just tweak this a little bit?
What sure.
About if someone is potentially a sub, subcontractor?
So you're providing consulting services to a subcontractor.
Or someone who becomes a subcontractor. Yeah, or, you know, whatever. Just because we see a lot of subs with Clamato.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm just sort of curious.
I don't think we would be talking about, there is a provision about income from an interested party that may trigger substantial interest or duty. We would need to talk about that and the broader conflict that Patty talked about, that interfering with your ability to participate fairly and objectively. We'd need to talk about both of those depending on the facts of the situation.
A disclosure at a minimum.
As a disclosure at a minimum, yeah. Yes. I always encourage transparency. Right. There's no harm to it.
Phil, if we tweak this one more way, instead of it being the board member that provides the consulting services, suppose it is the board member's spouse or live-in partner. How does that change the analysis?
It doesn't actually change the analysis at all from what I described, because the household member's interests are imputed to you. It's as if it's the same thing. So in the final scenario, I promise something that's pretty common. And this one we talk about every year because it actually comes up. The board members, as you do, you attend the important APTA annual conference, and you get all sorts of invitations to events surrounding the conference. So for these, again, let's hit on our main points. Seek advice. These are extremely fact-dependent. And as are all, but I spend quite a bit of time on these in particular, talking to the sponsors of the events to get all the facts that I need. And again, disclosure is big. But to go through the analysis itself. So with gifts, same 4 points. Is it a gift? Yes, it's a gift. The dinner is something of value. Is it from a prohibited source? Well, again, we just don't have enough facts here. We don't know whether this doesn't state here whether the rail car manufacturer is doing business with Metro, seeking business with Metro, consulting with Metro. Again, remember that other category of prohibited source that they are giving you the invitation because you are a board member, maybe staff. Metro didn't get this, but the board members did. That would seem to indicate they're giving it to you because you're a board member. So we need to determine, is it coming from a prohibited source? If it is, it needs to meet an exception in order for you to take the gift. The most likely exception here is widely attended, and this one we put right in the code. We need to talk because it is, again, very fact-dependent. It's not just what it sounds like, widely attended. It's not just the number of people going. We look at things a bit, whether it's by invitation only. Is it focused on one business or the industry in general? Is it part of the regular program? I have a list of about 10 questions that I send to sponsors of these sort of events. So if we find that it's not a widely attended gathering and doesn't meet any of the other exceptions, you need to decline the invitation. But if it does, step 4, always report the gift. I can help you with that as well. Now, once you're done with that, I've said those are the main points, it's not quite over yet. Because now that you've accepted a gift from a prohibited source, let's just say an interested party, be aware, whenever you have that interaction with an interested party, you could be triggering a conflict situation as well. So you might be fine as to the gift, but now accepting the gift, you might be in a situation, if a matter comes before the board affecting this rail car manufacturer, you may need to make something like a declaration or recuse yourself. So that's a situation where you may want to balance your duties, the benefit of attending the dinner versus the benefit of participating in Metro Matters, if that's actually the case, if there's something that's likely to come to the board.
Question.
Before you move on, could you describe how the definition of the of conflict of interest under the compact differs from that under the code? Did I hear you say
yes?
COI under the code is a narrower.
Right. Right.
We focus a lot on the code, but I'm curious about
the compact is really talking about a small subset of what's in the code of ethics.
It's the opposite.
Yes, okay. It's talking about having a direct or indirect financial interest in a contract or agreement with Metro, just to paraphrase.
Contract or agreement.
Right.
Got it.
So, or does it say financial transaction?
Financially interested either directly or indirectly in any contract, sale, purchase, lease, transfer, rental, personal property to which the board or the authority is a party.
So just to paraphrase, if it looks like you're doing business with Metro,
right.
That's we're talking about a compact situation.
That is a concept. That concept of conflict of interest, and specifically interest in a contract, is different from a law firm partner having an interest in an enterprise, is it not? That is,
well, yes and no.
That is, yeah.
It so. Could conceivably.
So I recall in the code there are a series of tests for essentially materiality.
Right. But if a board member is a partner in a law firm and receiving income
right.
from the
interested party,
do you have that indirect financial interest?
Right.
This is, again, something we'd have to explore, right. whether it rises to a compact situation.
Right. So is it the case that you might not have an interest, according to the definition of duty or interest under the code, but still have an interest under the compact? That's what I'm...
I don't think so. I think just about any compact violation would constitute a conflict of interest under the code of ethics, but that would really be the least of your concerns in that
right.
scenario. Because the compact is presenting a bar, and the code of ethics conflict could be resolved through either recusal or making a declaration. So we'd have to get around that compact question before we would even explore the code of ethics.
And Phil, does the same apply? You've used a dinner here as an example, but a reception.
Yeah. Anything of value would present a gift scenario. So cocktail reception, handouts over a certain value, all of it would be a gift situation.
And the analysis would be the same, right? Was it the one they attended, what the value of the reception is, was it invitation only, and so dinners in these type of association dinners tend to be more likely to be invitation only. The value is greater, so that they're more likely not to be considered widely attended events. But we go through the same analysis.
I want to ask a question on this. If we as a board member and a WMATA employee receive an invitation to go to a dinner at, say, a conference together?
Well, that would probably relate more to whether it's a widely attended gathering, whether it makes an exception, because if the rail car manufacturer, or let's just make it something else, if that entity is not an interested party, the only question we're asking then, is it a prohibited source because it's giving you the invitation because you're a board member? Well, the fact that an employee was also invited would tend to indicate that it's not because you're a board member, it's because you're attending a conference, let's say. That's one of the questions I asked them. And in fact, it has sometimes turned on whether the sponsor is inviting everybody at the conference or just a handful of people.
And in that scenario, both the board member would be analyzed through the board's code of ethics, and if the gift could be accepted, then there'd be a gift reporting requirement, and then the employee would go through the WMATA employee code of ethics and do the exact same thing. Mm-hmm. And in general, the widely attended event exception is very similar between what a board member can accept and what a employee can accept. Okay. Any other questions?
So if you don't have a material duty or interest under the ethics code, you don't have a conflict. If you don't have a conflict by virtue of a duty or interest under the code, you don't have a conflict under the compact. I'm just sort of with these two standards, how they interact with each other.
I mean, the compact doesn't define substantial duty or interest, it just says a financial interest, directly or indirectly.
Got
it's
it.
Code
in a contract.
And it's defined. I mean, we would use it as guidance. I think one of the easiest examples of an absolute prohibition that would not be resolved through recusal or declaration is, for example, you are the CEO of a rail car manufacturer, and you are bidding, or you have the contract with WMATA, you would just not be able to be a board member.
Right.
And that's probably the, you know, a clear example of something that is absolutely prohibited by the compact, and that recusal nor declaration would be able to resolve that, and you just wouldn't be able to be a board member in that situation.
Gotcha.
That's really what the compact conflict of interest, that's why it's so strict. It's that sort of scenario.
Yeah. Stricter but narrower.
Exactly. Yes. Absolutely. Okay. Stricter but narrower. Exactly.
Gotcha.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions?
Can I go back to the nonprofit scenario? So
sure.
If you're working with a nonprofit, if you as a member of the nonprofit, that maybe advocating for the policies that impact Metro, is there a declaration?
So there you're saying you're a member of the nonprofit. You're not saying you're a board member. You just belong to the nonprofit. Yeah. So that wouldn't trigger the conflict of interest in terms of substantial interests or duties in an interested party. The question would be, would it compromise your ability to participate fairly and objectively? I would always encourage transparency. We could discuss sort of situation where we would discuss whether it rises to that conflict of interest standard or whether just disclosing it is enough or whether you ought to seek making a declaration.
Right. So if you're like one of 10,000 members of a nonprofit, you're not on the board, you're not the CEO or the president, you just happen to be a member and you're interested in it, you should disclose that, but, you know, it's unlikely that that would require a recusal, but it should be disclosed in any event. Because if you're saying that that organization does something that would impact the mom. Any other questions? Take a question from
there's a question from the gallery.
Tina, can I just ask the nature of your question? Because this is really a committee meeting, but is there something, because you're involved in the ACCL.
Yeah, I'm just wondering to what extent it applies to members of advisory committees. Any of this?
It is. The Board Code of Ethics does not apply to members of the advisory committee. I believe, I'm not certain, that the committees have their own code of ethics. I know at one time, I'm getting a head shake. No. At one time they did, but I guess they do not now.
Thank you.
Okay, any other questions on the scenario? We just have our wrap-up slide. And we're we thank you for your attention. We encourage you to review the Code of Ethics throughout the year. And if you have questions, please seek advice, because that's what we're here to help you. And disclose, disclose, disclose. All right? Thank you.
Nothing personal.
Good. I'm fine.
Okay. Next, we have the audit piece. Welcome, Elizabeth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Give John a moment there to set up. All right. All right. Well, good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. Welcome to our annual training of audit awareness. Our topic for this year is Board Oversight Responsibility for Internal Controls and Internal Audit and External Audit Activities. My name is Elizabeth Sullivan with WMATA's Office of Management Audits, Risk, and Compliance, and I will be taking us through our discussion this afternoon. Our session today will satisfy the audit awareness training requirement of the board. It will help us reinforce board's knowledge of internal control, and it will provide us an opportunity to discuss board oversight responsibilities using guidance from the standards provided by the Committee of Sponsoring Organization of the Trade Rate Commission, or COSO, its five components for internal control, as well as the related principles. Our discussion of monitoring, which is one of the five components, would allow us to talk a bit about the responsibilities for board oversight responsibilities for external and internal audit activities. As we wrap up, we would also talk about, we'll provide the board with brief information of the FTA fiscal year 2020 triennial review that is forthcoming. Before we get started, just wanted to mention that we have some executive level summary information that was provided to you because it contains a lot more information that we can cover in our session today. So we would refer to them as we go through our discussion, but those are available for you to take away. So let's get right into our session. We'll start by revisiting the definition for internal controls, and I say revisiting because I am sure that members of the board are familiar with the term internal control on some level. But as we go through the definition as provided in your material, some key words that we should note. Internal control is a process that's affected by people, starting with the board. It provides reasonable assurance and it points to the achievement of objectives. Just to talk about some very key concepts in that definition, it's geared towards the achievement of objectives. Also, in more than one category, so in a lot of organizations, objectives are defined. They're typically operational objectives, reporting objectives, compliance objectives, or sometimes you have strategic objectives. And these are typically performance objectives altogether. Another key concept for internal control is that it's a process. It consists of ongoing tasks and activities. Internal control itself is a means to an end and not an end in itself. One other key concept, and John, we can keep moving up the slides here because they highlight some of our key concepts. They're affected by people. So as we think about internal controls, people think in terms of policies and procedures, manuals, systems, forms, and things of that nature that we actually use to conduct internal controls. But it's not just about that. It's also about the people that are responsible to perform these internal controls as well as the actions they take every day at different levels in the organization.
You know, Elizabeth, let's just stop for a second. Johnny, you caught up?
I'm having some technical difficulties.
Yeah.
Okay. Sir, I'm sorry. I can give you paper copies if you'd like to follow along.
Yeah. Sorry about that.
No problem
about
it. Don't
know what happened.
Okay.
It's up on my screen.
I
think that's
it's actually advancing. It's highlighting some of the key concepts in red, so that's
sorry.
Probably why you may not know that it's advancing.
Yeah, I saw it.
Automation. All right, just to kind of circle back here in terms of other things that are notable about internal controls. Again, these are things that the board may be familiar with. Internal control is adaptable, as you know. It could be used at the entity. It's flexible in its application. It could be used in different subset of an organization. Internal control is everyone's responsibility, and that's one of the key takeaways from this discussion. As we talk about roles and responsibilities for internal controls, one of the things that we wanted to use to highlight that is this model that's illustrated, available to you in your materials, the three lines of defense model, just used to illustrate the responsibilities for internal control. So when an organization has clearly defined its business objectives, the risks to meeting those objectives can be identified, and controls that can assist in meeting those objectives can also be put in place. When controls are placed into operation, they provide a reasonable assurance that objectives will be met. We spoke about reasonable assurance being one of the key concepts for internal control. Another key concept we talked about for internal control was that they're affected by people. So it's not about just the policies and procedures and things that are kind of the underlying internal control activities, but of course the people. So here at WMATA, everyone has some responsibility for internal control, and everyone has a part in assuring that essential duties are performed as intended. So this model kind of takes us through everyone's role and responsibilities when it comes to internal control. As you would imagine, it starts with a board of directors. The board of directors have oversight responsibility for internal control. This, of course, is done by providing a tone at the top, governing through policies. The general manager and the chief executive officer also has a responsibility here. The general manager is responsible for maintaining and monitoring the system of internal control, along with members of the executive management team and senior management, all have accountability for the design and operating effectiveness of internal control. Management is responsible for developing processes and procedures that ensure that appropriate records and supporting documentation exists and are retained to confirm that internal controls were appropriately performed. Staff assigned to implement controls have the responsibility to perform these controls completely and accurately. Of course, for us to get the true value from internal controls, they actually have to be performed. The responsibility for staff can also be illustrated with these three lines of defense, and we'll kind of talk about what these three lines mean here. The reason why we use this illustration is it shows that we as all parts of the organization have this collective responsibility for internal control, but we also have different levels of accountability for internal controls. So speaking about the first line, which is the first one there, if you advance the slide, it would actually show an arrow. That's not working. All right. Well, the first line of defense is lies with the business processes and the owners of activities and functions within the organization that create or manage the risks. There we go. That's the first line of defense. All right, reporting up to management. The first line of defense, of course, are those that manage our, they have the primary responsibility for internal controls. They own the business operations, they manage them, the risks are theirs first, the controls as well are theirs first. So they are our first line of defense. The second line of defense is pretty much functions within the organization that the executive management puts in place to ensure that those in the first line are doing exactly what they should be doing. So in a lot of organizations, you would have quality assurance functions. Here we have our safe organization to help manage specific risks and controls around safety. So that would be a second line of defense functions. And, of course, these are tailored to different organizations. Again, demonstrating roles and responsibilities for risk and controls in terms of the third line of defense, you would have organizations like ours, which is Management Audits, Risk, and Compliance. So independent audits and assurance services provided by our organization as WMATA's internal audit function serves as a third line of defense. WMATA's Management Audits, Risk, and Control function collaborates with the OIG, who also has an audit function, and these functions work together to ensure what we call combined assurance. Of course, as you know, the board has the OIG office has a responsibility directly to the board of directors. All right, so what would I like to do right now is to talk about the guidelines available for board oversight responsibility in our next slide. I know I've mentioned COSO earlier on. Let's talk a little bit about that. If you're not familiar with COSO, the Committee of Sponsoring Organizations of the Trade Rate Commission, or COSO, is a private sector initiative established back in 1985. It's made up of five different organizations, and it's put forth this internal control framework that's well accepted and is used by organizations to evaluate the effectiveness of their internal control system. The framework has five components and 17 principles that have to be present and functioning. And what we'll do is talk through some of these principles in highlighting board oversight responsibility when it comes to individual components. Members of the board may be familiar with the GAO Green Book, which provides the similar standards for internal control for the federal government. So now let's briefly talk about the five components along with the individual board responsibilities that align to those components. So the first component is control environment. Control environment is the foundation For all other components of internal control, providing the discipline, the process, and structure as established by the board and senior management. The standards and the structure set by control environment provides the basis for carrying out internal controls across the organization. The board of directors and senior management established the tone at the top regarding the importance of internal control and expected standards of conduct. As you can see represented in your materials are the five principles of the first component of internal controls, and our next slide provides the specific board responsibilities related to those components. So if we can have our next slide. So if I can ask the board to just take a moment and look at the six specific oversight responsibilities highlighted for the board. I will try not to go through these items one by one since they're available there, but I'm sure as you look at these items, you would agree that these are, in fact, responsibilities of the board. Guidelines provide that the board should establish oversight structures that align with the objectives of an organization, and as you know, we have different committees that align, in fact, to a matter structure to provide this oversight responsibility. The board should establish integrity and ethical values. The board should certainly provide and promote the standards of conduct for the organization. It is an oversight responsibility of the board to ensure that the standards for competence is clear for the organization. The board is also responsible for ensuring that its own oversight process is also effective. Some boards actually conduct a self-assessment to ensure that their own oversight activities are, in fact, meeting expectations for the organization. The next component of the COSTA internal control framework in our next slide is risk assessment. The second component has four principles aligned with it. Risk assessment is the identification and analysis of relevant risks to the achievement of an organization's objectives and forms the basis for how risks should be managed. A precondition for risk assessment, however, is the establishment of clearly stated objectives at different levels within an organization. This enables risks to be properly identified. Risk assessment component also requires that management considers when there are changes to its internal and external environment so as to ensure that these risks are being considered. As you know, business would always change. The environment changes. Things happen that would present different challenges. Given that, risk assessment component requires that management considers changes to this environment and properly identify new risks as they arise. And our next slide, highlighting the oversight responsibility for the board, given the risk assessment component, we have four specific oversight responsibilities highlighted here. And as you take a moment and look at those items as stated, I'm sure you would agree that these are, in fact, responsibilities for the board. Our guidance shows that oversight responsibility when it comes to risk assessment for the board should ensure that management is, in fact, assessing its risks and managing those risks appropriately. So in terms of risk assessments that are conducted by management, the board should be interested in getting that information. The board should also consider potential significant changes, fraud, management override of internal controls. The board should ensure that when there are significant risks to the achievement of the objectives of an organization, the management presents that information to them, and the board requires such information. And also, the board should ensure in its oversight role that management is proactively thinking through innovations, things that change, technology changes to budget, as well as political shifts that may affect the achievement of objectives. In our next slide, we have our third component for internal controls, control activities. Control activities are the policies and procedures which help ensure that management's directives are carried out. They help ensure that activities and actions that are taken to address risks to achieve an organization's objectives, in fact, take place, because this is exactly what this control activities are. Control activities should be performed at various stages within the organization, and they should include controls over technology. A lot of things that we do today are technology-enabled. So, of course, when we think about internal controls, the controls over technology would also be important. Controls can be in various shapes and forms. They could be manual. They could be automated in nature. We talked about technology controls. We would expect the management would have technology controls that are automated as well. Controls could be preventive in that they are helping to prevent something from happening, or they could be detective in nature in that they are helping identify when something has in fact happened. Controls could also be corrective in nature. So with these three principles stated by our framework, our next slide talks about them specifically as it relates to the board's oversight responsibility. So as we think about board's oversight responsibility for control activities, our guidance says that the board should provide oversight to management in the development and the performance of control activities. Also, the board should be making specific inquiries of management regarding their selection, the development, the deployment of control activities for significant risk areas. Obviously, there are some things that may not rise to the level for board concern, but in terms of the board's oversight responsibility, these inquiries should be of a regular nature.
Sorry,
yes.
Just to refresh, these principles are GSA promulgated?
So,
whose principles are these?
So I mentioned earlier on that
yes.
They were from the COSO framework. Right, but very much aligned with the GAO framework.
GAO.
It's actually the exact same thing. So what they do is, I've heard it referred to as GAO Green Book is COSO for the government. So it's all 17 principles are exact same. They're just applied to the federal scenario. And
okay.
All five components are the exact same.
I missed that part. I'm sorry.
No problem. And also in your reference material, you have those details as well. So you could take home with you for happy reading.
Yeah, thank you. Don't ask questions.
So if I may direct your attention back to the control activities again, as you think about that, do you see anything on there that you would not expect to see from a board oversight responsibility as it comes to control activities? Again, this is something that I know that the board does very well. I know almost after every session in committee session, there are questions that management takes back and has to bring information back to the board. So, of course, that is that is the board acting in its oversight capacity. All right. Our fourth component, information and communication. Information and communication involves the identification, capture, and communication of data and pertinent business information in a form and time frame that enables an organization's people to carry out their responsibilities. So here you have three specific principles that are provided by our framework, again, in alignment with the GAO Green Book. Given these principles, we have some board-specific responsibilities on our next slide. So in its oversight role, the board should communicate direction at as well as the tone at the top. The board should also discuss information that relates to the organization's achievement of its objectives. So there should be this open dialogue that the board allows and facilitates. The board should also ensure that they involve themselves in the review of disclosure to external stakeholders. I'm sure a lot of information comes across your desk through the board secretary. Also, the board should allow for this upward communication of issues, so making yourself available to ensure that information can be brought so that as needed to provide your oversight responsibility, exercise your oversight responsibility, that information will be made available to you. So if we move over to our final component, and I'm trying to be sensitive to our time here. So our fifth component is monitoring. Monitoring helps to ensure that internal controls continue to operate effectively and involves the assessment by appropriate personnel within a suitable time frame. This component requires ongoing and separate evaluations of control. Separate evaluations are conducted with various scopes and frequency, as you would imagine, and this is typically based on risk. So this component requires, as you can see with the two principles noted, that the board be interested in the results of evaluations that are conducted, and this would even be if those are internal or external to the organization. So moving over to the next slide to talk about oversight responsibility when it comes to monitoring. Monitoring is where the board oversight responsibility for internal and external audit activities come into play. The board should assess and oversee the nature and scope of evaluations of the organization, again, whether they are conducted as internal reviews or assessments or audits or external audits. In its oversight role, the board should be interested in the results of these audits. The board should also be interested in corrective actions that are developed by management in response to audit findings. The board should also be interested in management's progress in remediating these corrective actions. Here at WMATA, we have obviously internal audit functions that are under management, which will be my organization. We also have the OIG Office of Audit that also has a reporting relationship with the board. So in your package, there's information in detail that expresses the responsibilities of both audit functions, so I wouldn't go over that here. Also in its oversight role, I think one of the things we would leave you with here in terms of what the board should be doing when it comes to internal and external audit activities. In your oversight role, you should engage with management and internal and external auditors to ensure that the information on audit activities are made available to you so that you can make appropriate decisions. I think earlier on we talked about making informed decisions as members of the board when it comes to the code of ethics. Same thing applies here as part of the oversight role for internal controls as well as internal and external audit activities. Management, of course, also has a role here to make sure that information is made available to the board so that you can, in fact, have information necessary. So that said, I think it's appropriate to share with you that in terms of external audit activities, we actually have a scheduled FTA comprehensive review or triennial review for fiscal year 2020. If we move over to the next slide, there's just some highlights there. So WMATA received notification on October 31st, indicated that FTA will be conducting its triennial review in fiscal year 2020. The triennial review is one of FTA's management tools for examining recipients' performance and adherence to current FTA rules and policies. It also examines how recipients meet statutory and administrative requirements of FTA awards. Some members of the board may recall that we had this same review 3 years ago back in FY 2017. The review generally includes three phases. There is a pre-site visit where we are provided with something called a recipient information request, a series of questions and documents that FTA would like us to provide the reviewer. Management is currently in that stage for this particular review since our notification in October. Management has been working to get information together as requested by FTA, and those responsible for this task are on track to get this information to FTA by December 20th. This triennial review also includes a site visit where FTA will be here for about a week to evaluate all the information that's being collected. What you have displayed right now are the 21 areas for which FTA has possible reviews. There are over 400 requirements that will be evaluated as part of FTA's triennial review assessment, as well as over 129 indicators of control that would be also indicators of compliance that would be evaluated as well. We are awaiting confirmation on the on-site visit day, but FTA has scheduled us for an on-site training for this particular triennial review in January. So they will be going over all the requirements that they would evaluate us against and provide us an opportunity to ask them questions and get fully trained right here on site. So we appreciate that. Post-site visit, one of the things that we would expect, there would be an exit conference at the end of the week while FTA is here on site. They will provide us at that time with a draft report with any findings from that review. And as you can see, it's a very comprehensive review. A lot of FTA reviews have a very focused area. It's either on procurement or it's on financial management or it's on another topic. This is a very comprehensive review. It spans all elements of award management. Once FTA conducts its exit meeting, they give us a draft report. 2 weeks from that, WMATA would have to provide a response to the draft. And 45 days from that, we would expect to get a final report from FTA. One of the things that the internal audit function is doing in preparation for this is an audit readiness assessment, just to basically we would be performing the exact same review as FTA. They actually make their manuals available to us, so we would avail ourselves of that and conduct a similar review to help management prepare for this assessment. So we will kick that off actually this month, and we'll continue, efforts will continue through FTA site visit, on-site visit. So, Mr. Chairman, that concludes the training session and information session. I certainly appreciate your time. I know it's hard at this time of the day, and I'm happy to answer your questions. Mr. Goldman?
I said I was sort of prolonging the three questions on the training overview. Who conducts the review? Does the FDA have an internal audit function, or does it hire an outside contractor? Second, is the report
okay. Thank you for your questions, Mr. Goldman. So FTA, as normal practice, would have consultants conduct the reviews. We actually know the consultant. We were notified. That information is also available to you as a TFC consultant. I don't think that FTA keeps that private. All of their reviews are done by consultants. In terms of the review, once it's completed, the report will, in fact, be made public. That's been FTA's trend. They are making changes to how we communicate with them in the next upcoming fiscal year in a new system they've provided to us. So I'm not sure how that information would look like in the future, but typically the report itself is made publicly available. And does the board have any specific responsibility? Well, again, back to the oversight responsibility for the board, just from an internal standpoint, we certainly would want to keep you informed in terms of what FTA finds and how management is reacting to that. But in terms of responsibility directly to FTA, there is no specific board responsibility. They may address some of their communication about this to the chairman of the board, because I've seen that in the past, as well as the general manager. It is, in fact, the responsibility of management, and one of the things my group does is help facilitate that.
Anything else? Okay. Elizabeth, in Section 4, you mentioned the board secretary. What exactly is the responsibility?
I'm not sure, Jennifer. What do you think?
Anyway, okay, if there are no questions... Elizabeth, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
You know, your department does a lot of important work that doesn't get a lot of attention sometimes, so appreciate that very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. If there's no further business, we'll stand adjourned. All right?
Thank you.
Thanks. Appreciate your time.